Hello, welcome to another episode of Sounds Like Comics, the podcast devoted to all things comic books in movies and TV. I'm Luke.
And I'm Jay. Welcome to the podcast.
Today's topic, Star Trek First Contact. It is the eighth movie of the Star Trek franchise and the second starring the cast of the TV series Star Trek The Next Generation. This is your warning. We will be talking spoilers.
First one directed by Jonathan Frakes. Funnily enough, trivia right off the bat, rumored that they had initially approached both Ridley Scott and John McTiernan to direct this.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but they wanted someone who like got Star Trek, which is why eventually they just offered it to Frakes, which is probably the smartest idea they had. I think John McTiernan could have done something really clever with this. Ridley Scott, I can't recall him ever doing an intellectual property that was an Alien, which he started. So,
yeah, no, that's a good point. It's interesting that those two directors had their names thrown around, but I can't imagine anyone else other than Jonathan Frakes directing this movie. And it's not just, for me, a Star Trek film. It's the best one. For me, it is the best one. And it's interesting that if you're looking at the original series cast, for most people, their best one is The Wrath of Khan, which
also
was
their second outing.
True, but also was a follow-up to an episode of the TV show. And then you've got First Contact, which followed on from that two-part episode. Help me out here.
Those Left Behind?
No. What's the Borg episode with
the cutest?
Was that one? The two-parter. Oh, I've completely derailed it. But my point being, though, it was
It
followed on from episodes.
Season two cliffhanger.
The best
went into
of both
the start
worlds.
Of season three. Yes,
that's what it is. I knew what it was when I started talking, and it completely left my head. I completely forgot. But yes, Jonathan Frakes to everybody is known as William Riker. So he's both starring in this movie. He's directing outside of Star Trek. He's done other things as well. He was the host of the anthology series Beyond Belief, Fact or Fiction. He voiced a character in the Disney animated series Gargoyle. He was the human character in that. So he's done other stuff. But do you know what? He's mainly done Star Trek, and that's okay. We love him for it. He's done so much Star Trek over the years. See, you're right. They wanted somebody who got Star Trek. And he'd already directed episodes of the TV series. So he just seemed like a good fit.
More than any other cast member of a Star Trek show as well. He has, even at the time, had directed more than anyone else. I think out of the Next Gen cast, second only to LeVar Burton is the second one. But it's a long way. Like, LeVar Burton's directed a lot, even recently, but pales in compared to the amount by Frakes. But also, you know, like Nimoy, of course, famously directed some of the films, but Frakes was the first one of the Next Gen crew to helm a film. And it's all the better for it. His familiarity with the crew, familiarity with the subject matter, the cast, I trust him implicitly. The writers and everything, it's all across the whole board. You couldn't have like picked a better director, really. Especially given like we both like Generations, but it was, and that was one of the someone who had directed episodes of the series, but that was a last minute thing as well. They needed someone available for like whilst, because they're still shooting the season of the show when they're filming the film, like Generations, whereas this big budget, don't have that constraint of having to work around shots for their weekly series. They can go on, they can do it as they want. with the, as how they want new Enterprise, new uniforms that have actually been produced for the cast for this movie. So no more.
The best uniforms. Yeah, not like Generations where they were raiding the wardrobe of DS9 to get costumes that didn't fit them completely, just fit them enough. You know, you say you're bigger budget, $45 million. You know, we recently reviewed GoldenEye, which came out a year before this in 95. And I was surprised that had a budget of just $60 million. Yet here we are, a year later, a Star Trek film, sci-fi, with a budget of $45 million, a film that went on to make at the box office $146 million, almost three times the budget. But for me, this was like the proper first big theatrical Star Trek film with the next gen. Generations, we both like it a lot, but it did have that TV feel. The passing of the torch worked really well. But this was like big screen action.
Yeah, and an interesting thing, you know, you've got, like you said, it's sort of a continuation from the best of both worlds. They were never happy with the uniforms and the way the Borg looked on the TV show, being constrained by that budget and not being able to do much about it, with the fact that, you know, their budget has to be spent wisely. So they really went all out for them this time around. You got the horror elements really captivated, some of the body horror in this, not as far as you'd probably go these days, especially like Picard season one with some of the ex-Borg on that. They really showed it probably better because it's just what you can do with modern makeup techniques and stuff. But for the time, this was like quite like, whoa.
It really was. Yeah, I mean, they wanted to redesign them to appear as though they were converted into machine beings from the inside out. So a bit more like focusing more on the horror than what we got in the TV show. But with that, though, the new makeup sessions took four times as long as when they did the TV show.
Yeah. That being said, they also wanted them to be updated because they were going to be big on Voyager, and this design and these costumes and these techniques and even the sets were recycled to be pushed forward for when they were using them for Voyager, which they were really forward thinking, again, making sure that those dollars like really went far. It's like, oh, we can't just be using like this set one off. We really want, how can we really make this efficient and economical for like, for future, like, can we work this back into the show later on? But it all comes together really smartly, really wise. And all of our typical next gen guys are back. We've got obviously Patrick Stewart back as Jean-Luc Picard, my favorite captain. Can't help myself.
I'm right there with you. But what's different about this Picard? In fact, did you mention it when we reviewed Generations that they had Picard in like what would have been previously a Kirk role,
where he was
doing a bit of action? This is the movie where they turned Picard into a bit of an action hero.
Yeah.
The bit where he's got up against the Borg in the third act, he's got the sleeveless Federation uniform.
Yeah.
He's going for it. It's full John McClane.
There's a reason for that. It was supposed to be the other way around. It was supposed to be Riker up on the ship fighting the Borg, and Picard on the ground doing the stuff with Cochrane. But Patrick Stewart, like when they're gearing up, was like, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't make sense. Picard's the one with the history. He'd be the one on the ship. And I'm like, you know what? He's not wrong.
You blow my mind.
That's why it works.
I can see them writing it for Riker because that was the difference with the Next Generation. Because the whole thing is that the captain really should stay on the ship. It's too much of a risk. The captain just beaming down to planets every episode. So he really should be on the ship. So when Next Gen came along, Picard would be on the ship. Riker would go on the away missions.
Yeah.
Of course, that changed later on, but the idea is that Riker was the Kirk type. So that's interesting.
Yeah, he's like, no, I'll make sure it's safe before you go put yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting that they changed it, but do you know what? Patrick Stewart pulls it off. So I never knew that.
Yeah.
But it makes sense.
I didn't know until I read his memoirs, Making It So, when he talks about that. And, you know, give it to Frakes. Like, he's very smart and goes, you know what? I agree. It's Picard who's got the history. He'd be more emotional. He wouldn't make the rational, smarter choice here. And it helps frame parts of the movie even better. I'm like, you know what? Smart choice. And it's brought up early enough that when they flipped it, it doesn't impact. And like, it doesn't stand out until you hear that. You go, oh, yeah, that would have been a Riker role.
It always worked for me, and it still works for me. But as soon as you said that, it just clicked. I'm like, absolutely, that makes sense. But I like that Stewart's getting to do more here. And you buy that he is out of character, but it's because of what happened to him on the TV show.
Yeah.
And then
there's multiple episodes of him with PTSD afterwards. Like,
yeah, so you got the two-parter, which was a season...
Earth Space Doc.
Yeah, but when they did The Best of Two Worlds, from memory, it was a season finale and a season premiere, wasn't it? It was a big cliffhanger between seasons.
Picard's... the actors have all said, because they went to, like, conventions and stuff, and Patrick Stewart didn't think anything of it until he was in... He's driving through L.A. one day, and a car pulls up behind him and yells out, "You ruined our summer," because it was fans like they'd never had that before. It got resolved. And if there was going to be a two-parter, you only had to wait a week, not 3 months. How dare they?
It is a long time to wait. So what they're doing different with Picard in his reaction to the Borg. The character I really like in this, Lily Sloan, played by Alfie Woodard.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic, because she's able to cut through all the bullshit and just tell Picard straight. She's able to say things to him that none of the crew would dare say to him. So I thought she was a great character to have there. And then when he has his little paddy, it is... in his office, and he's breaking up the models and throwing them. Yeah, it's a great scene, and just having a character like that, because nobody, not Beverly, nobody could speak to him like she did.
No, like Worf has the courage to speak out first of like, "Sir, we should blow up the Enterprise," because he's the tactical officer and it's the smart tactical move. And he gets chewed out because of it. And then everyone else is just like, "Nope, all right, snipe too." Yeah, and she, like you said, she's the one who calls him out because she doesn't know anything. It's like, "You're being a moron. How are you being? This is all revenge. Don't give me your high morals. I can see what's happening."
Yeah.
And it works so well. The Moby Dick metaphor.
Which, of course, he can
quote off the top of his head because
Jean-Luc Picard. Absolutely. Yeah.
Such a great line as well.
Yeah, mentioned Worf. Hey, listen, I love that he's here. I really, really do. But it's so convenient. The USS Defiant just so happens to turn up. Ship gets damaged. Yeah. Let's beam Worf aboard so we can be in our movie.
Yeah, it was something they had to work with. They're like, "We know we want him back because he's part of the next gen crew. It'd be weird if he wasn't. What possible reason can we have?" And that's what they came up with. The irony is the Defiant that he's in at the start was specifically designed to take on the Borg. And then its first battle against the Borg, it was supposed to get destroyed. But the writer of the film, who's also one of the writers on DS9, was like, you can't use this show's ship and destroy it in a movie that it's not connected to.
That's not right. Unfair. And that was the big thing about DS9, like the difference between Next Gen, Voyager. They were stuck in one place on the space station. The Defiant gave them the ability to leave and go on adventures on a ship.
Yeah, so they didn't have to wait for adventure. They could go somewhere.
Yeah, they can't have this movie blowing up their ship. I agree with the writer. Absolutely.
Yeah, Ronald Moore, well done.
Yes.
High praise, sir. Not only did you write a great movie, but you're standing up for like, no, let's be sensible. That doesn't make sense. Also, the helmsman on the Defiant, Adam Scott.
No.
It is, yeah. Young what? Adam Scott, no facial hair. Look at him.
Oh my like, Google goodness, it. Really?
That's it. Yeah, that's him right there. It's
crazy. I just watched this movie again.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, look, there's a guy from Parks and Rec. Adam Scott, there he is. I mean, he's got blood down the side of his face.
Yeah, it's right. Like, oh, wow.
There's this vessel coming in. Sirs, the Enterprise. That's Adam Scott.
I had no idea. I was thinking the most recent thing I watched Adam Scott in was Madam Web. But since Madam Web, I've watched Star Trek First Contact again. So, okay. The last thing I watched Adam Scott in was this. And not Madam Web. Brent Spiner, back as Data. Wow. Great arc for him. You know, he's
really
continuing to want to be more human. And then what the Borg Queen can do for him, and she starts grafting flesh. So he's had emotion chips before, but now he's actually getting flesh.
Yeah, and it's a sensation he's couldn't comprehend, because you know when he touches things, he has high senses detail, so he can like sense things a person can't. Like there's a micro fracture in this, or oh, it's imperfect, and things of that nature is. Strength and like small movements and things of that nature are far above ours, but simply being able to feel like air pressure on his skin is something completely new to him. And the way they do it, it's cheeky and it's seductive, you know, blows on the hairs, and you see it, the goose pimples and with like a what is this? In an almost euphoric way. And then the sly little, was it good for you? So good. Like Alice Krieg.
Oh, she
phenomenal as the Borg Queen. She's
excellent. She is excellent.
Initially, with that, who's running the Borg, they needed it was supposed to be just a Borg computer, like a main computer.
I heard that as well, but there's no personality.
How do you make that work? So they're like, what if there was a single consciousness in a person that could relate back and forth, that's feeling things subjectively? Like, thank God they came up with the idea.
It's a solid idea. It's great. Casting for the part took time, as the actress needed to be sexy, dangerous, and mysterious. It was Frakes who cast her after seeing her in a movie she did in 1981, Ghost Story. But she really is perfect. I mean, it was a new thing at the time, whereas now the Borg Queen's pretty common. You know, whether it's season 2 of Picard or the iterations of Star Trek, we just know the Borg Queen to be a thing. But the fact that it first started in this movie, it was a very different thing, and she cast such a strong presence. And just like with The Wrath of Khan, you need a strong villain, like a really good villain.
Yeah, you really
do. We've got it in that movie, and we've got it in this movie. Yeah. She's fantastic.
The takes couldn't last any longer than 4 minutes. Because the contacts she used, like silver contacts, caused like a huge amount of pain and discomfort for her. So 4 minutes, take a break, wash out her eyes, and like calm back down, and then go again.
Wow.
Yeah. So she suffered for it. And apparently the costume is quite tight and restricting.
I mean, it looks it.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks fantastic. I mean, it's unfortunate she had to go through what she went through.
Under the on the top of her head, around where the pipe is, there's like little lights that you can see through the makeup, like underneath. It's really well designed. Like, it's like when you see her, you're like, yeah, that's an intimidating character. Like, you don't need to know it's the villain for you to be like, oh, It's just worked so well.
Apparently, so striking, Frakes, so iconic.
Yeah, he watched a bunch of movies to like get in the headspace for this, which was like the original Alien, Aliens, Blade Runner, and I think he's like Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, wow. You know, that's cool.
Things of that nature, because he's like, they got to be shocking. They got to be striking, and they got to like, and speaking of aliens, Jerry Goldsmith, whenever the Borg are on screen, from Aliens, that like that sharp like ching from when they're like in chase scenes from Aliens, he uses that cue, that sound cue for the Borg in this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which I'm like, clever, because it's such a sharp, unpleasant sound. Yeah. It helps you feel disturbed when they're on screen, especially, you know, they just, you can't shoot them. You got to go hand to hand. They stick those things in your neck and they're basically done. You're like, oh, man, it's the Cybermen. But, you know, we've said this, I think we've mentioned this before, but they're more terrifying. The Cybermen didn't get really this terrifying until like modern Doctor Who back in the mid-2000s. But
yeah,
Star Trek beat you to the punch. This is a much more devastating version of what that idea is.
Well, really, really is. And, you know, Jerry Goldsmith, I mean, wow, what a iconic composer, like massive back catalogue. We've reviewed a few of the films that he's scored. The Mummy.
Yeah.
Supergirl. The earlier, you know, original series Star Trek films.
Yeah.
And there's going to be more. I mean, looking at his back catalogue, Planet of the Apes, The Omen, Poltergeist, Gremlins, Total Recall, Basic Instinct, Air Force One, LA Confidential. I mean, the list just goes on and on. But that's interesting that I didn't realize he brought that sound back from Alien. That's smart.
Yeah, really smart. LeVar Burton back as Geordi, but without the visor.
For the first time. And apparently, he's been wanting to get rid of the visor for a long time because he's like saying, hey, I want to be able to show my eyes. I'm not able to emote as much when I've got that visor on. And this is the film where it happened. This film onwards, it doesn't have the visor. Instead, he's got ocular implants, which were shown to be artificial, but otherwise unexplained. That's all we need to know. We don't need to know the science behind it. All we need to know, it works.
Yeah, and they look cool.
Yes, absolutely.
yeah, like they see him show his eyes, and you can see like them spin as he like changes his vocal range and stuff. I'm like, it looks mechanical. Your brain can be like, oh, I can kind of see how that would work, the way they kind of iris like the lens of a camera.
And that's it. The eyes are focusing. So it's good that I'm going to say headband, the visor, because when I was a kid, I would wear my sister's headband and put it over my eyes and pretend I was Geordi. So it was like a bit silly looking, but it worked really well on the show and worked for like a number of years. But for reasons, you know, pointed out by Burton himself, they got rid of it. And then he's got the ocular implants. But all the next gen casts, when they're coming back, it's always great to see them. Gates McFadden, Beverly Crusher, Marina Sirtis, Deanna Troi. And she has some fun down on the planet, on Earth, with James Cromwell as Zephram Cochrane. Wow.
Father
what
of
a
the
guy.
Warp drive. James Cromwell actually says this is, out of all the characters he's played, this is the one closest to his own personality.
I did read that. I mean, some people know him as the farmer from Babe, but for me, it'll always be Zephram Cochrane. He's so good in this. And, you know, apparently at one time, they were looking at Tom Hanks.
For
Cochrane.
I don't know if it wouldn't be too distracting for me to see Tom Hanks in Star Trek.
Too big of a name. It would have been distracting, especially like a lot of the other cast members are from TV. It would have been, yeah, too distracting. Like, I know with the original series cast, you had people like Christopher Lloyd, you know, playing a Klingon in the third Star Trek film. But in these later films, I think it would have been too distracting. And James Cromwell is bloody fantastic. He is so good playing the drunk. And, oh, man, I love it.
Yeah,
I love him in these scenes. Like with Geordi, he's like, I need to take a leak. I don't need to take any leak. There's a lot of humor there.
Yeah, and I like the idea that some amazing man from the past who's a historical figure, and then it's that whole almost don't meet your heroes because he's nothing like the stories of the man that all these people have grown up with. He's so much more flawed and human because he's a drunk and he's not doing this because he had some great vision. It was Dora could make some money.
That's it. He's cynical, like, selfish, and then he's changed by meeting the characters, you know, in the movie, which is
it's so smart. And I like, because, you know, what would happen if you went back in time and met a historical famous person? You may have know the weight of their story and how long it lasts, but for them it's just, I'm just living life, I'm just doing my thing. Like,
what does he say to them? And so what are you on, some kind of Star Trek? Like, he says something along those lines.
First time it's ever ushered in Star Trek. In fact, I think maybe the only time.
Yeah, where Star Trek is actually said, but in an episode of Next Gen, Q says it's time to put an end to your trek through the stars.
Yeah, and that was, which I think is a better, cleaner way, the cleaner, smarter way of slipping it in there without.
But I do like it. And Cockrum is from the past. He's like, what do you want? Some kind of Star Trek? I don't know. I've always liked it. It works. Yeah,
it works. It works. And it works because it's someone, like I said, a historical person who's kind of derivative. Like, dismissive of the whole thing, like, from the future, you bunch of weirdos.
I mean, remind me, what was the original name that Gene Roddenberry was looking at for Star Trek? Was it something like Wagon Trek Across the Stars?
Yeah, Wagon Train to the Stars. Yeah,
that's it.
Because it was like his idea was the wagon, I think there was this. Like the wagon trains out to the Wild West because he grew up loving Westerns, and it's that whole idea. I think there was a famous example that he was thinking of as well, which I think was a successful show when he was like developing the original Star Trek. And that's where he, so that was his placeholder name before he was like, I got to come up with something snappier than that.
But I just I love the pitch because obviously Westerns went away. Star Trek has stayed, but it always intended to have been a Western in space. And it's like it's a secret Western. People just look at it as being a sci-fi. That's why I love Firefly and Serenity so much. It was very much in the vein of Star Trek being a Western in space.
Yeah, and that juxtaposition of something like the really old with the ridiculously new and advanced. But they don't think anything of it because for them it's old. It's really clever. And it is that spirit of adventure as well that, you know, you want, like, you're in space, man. Like, why aren't you excited?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many clever things with this. The day, first contact day, that they're having to make sure to get everything done. Date chosen. Not just an arbitrary date, April 5th, was Ronald Moore's son's birthday.
That's why I picked that date.
Yeah. I'm like, clever, you needed to pick a date. Might as well pick something that's important to you.
Yeah,
like,
something personal.
Yeah, and so, and it had never been previously set. So, you know, from here on out, like, his son's birthday will always be first contact day for Star Trek fans, which is great. Really nice. They, and it's never stated on screen, but the Vulcan who lands at the end of the movie to make first contact is Spock's grandfather.
What?
Yep.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, that's an in-universe, like, known fact that it was Spock's grandfather who made first contact, because their lives are so long, living for like 200, 250 years, that, yeah, by the time you get to the original Star Trek, they're only two generations removed.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes when they do things like that, it can make the world seem smaller, where everybody knows everybody, everyone's got a relationship. But that's pretty cool. But they don't say it in the movie, though. But that's...
Yeah, they don't say it, but it's
a known thing.
Like, yeah. Which I think works better, because if they'd found some really weird way of, like, if they'd used Leonard Nimoy or something, and people are like, why is that Spock? It's like, no, not him. But because also in continuity, like, that was just a survey thing. It wasn't supposed to be anything. Ooh, it just happened to have be Spock's father on grandfather on that ship. Like, yep. Nice little like bit of trivia for all those Star Trek fans out there. Yeah, which is cool. The special effects, man, ILM like killed it for this one. There's no use of I think I blew your mind when we talked about Generations and how that Klingon bird of prey explosion had been like, just used so many times. Nope, just not on this one. All new shots, completely new. The Millennium Falcon's supposed to be in that initial Borg fight to start, but no one's ever been able to spot it.
Oh, really? That's supposed to be a thing?
Yep, it's supposed to be in there, but no one's ever been able to pick it out.
You know, ILM had 5 months to finish this movie.
Yeah.
Such a tight schedule. Traditional optical effects techniques were supplemented with computer-generated imagery. But this, even like by today's standards, is a great-looking movie. We did lose the Enterprise D in that last movie. The Enterprise E is such a different looking Enterprise, but I've always liked it. Really sleek design.
Yeah. Like having been so familiar with the D for so long, its shape had just become iconic. So when you go in the cinema, you're on the big screen, you see the new ship. I mean, it looked so much, so sleek in comparison. Being that it's like so stretched out and long, it looked quick. You're like, wow.
Loved it. Man, loved the design. Bought the toy. I'm pretty sure from memory, it had sound effects, flashing lights. It definitely had sound effects. But yeah, it's a great looking ship, and it goes well with the new uniforms, which are my favorite of any iteration of Star Trek. It is
same.
These uniforms from this film, and consistent across the board, not like in Generations when everyone's wearing different uniforms.
Hodgepodge.
But yeah, the effects, the cast, the story, the villain, all of it. There's so much to love about this movie. But if you're going to rate it out of 5.
I'm coming in on 5. As we both already stated, like, this is the Star Trek film, especially out of the Next Gen cast. Like, they never, unfortunately, equaled it in terms of like hitting all of the highs here. Storyline, villain, the way it was shot, character beats for everyone. This just had all of it, just top notch across all everywhere. What they added to this history of Star Trek and going forward, and this is like a touchstone that everyone can think back to. The improvement to the Borg for the rest of the franchise moving forward as well. This has so much going for it. And I can't think of a single thing really that I'm like, didn't like that. It's like all of it just hits. Even finding a way to shoehorn in Robert Picardo as the emergency medical hologram because Voyager was of course on scene.
That yeah. was fun.
I'm a doctor, not a doorstop.
Yes, a McCoy line.
Yeah. Yeah, so good. Yeah, I might be biased, but I don't care. It's just, for me, it's flawless. How about yourself?
Oh, like you, it's an easy five. An easy five out of five. Definitely my favorite Star Trek film, but I'd go as far as saying it's one of my favorite films. It is absolutely fantastic. It's one of those films where you get to the end credits, I could just go back and watch it again. There's so much yeah. to enjoy. The time travel aspect is fun. And again, everything about it just works. And it is such a quick watch. And Jerry Goldsmith, the score is incredible. I love it. I absolutely love Star Trek First Contact. When we first said, hey, let's do the next gen films, I'm like, I really do enjoy Generations. But I was like, well, let's do Generations and then we can do First Contact. Because like, this is the one, isn't it? And then yeah, you know, really Insurrection is. Happens and Nemesis happens. But before that, we get this movie, which is, for me, perfect. 5 out of 5. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, that's it for our episode all about Star Trek First Contact.
If you'd like to contact us about this episode or suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, you can find us on Facebook at Sounds Like Comics Podcast.
You've been listening to Luke and Jay, the guys from Sounds Like Comics. See you soon.